tell us why they love each other, besides the fact that Zayden is hot and she has been, like, all wiggly down there since this first moment she saw him.
Lindbergh has a really good description of it. She says, they are like jellyfish helplessly grinding each other in the middle of the ocean, brainless. And that is such a good description.
Hi, guys, and welcome to another episode of Unresolved Textual Tension. It's me, your host, Maria, and with me today are my ruggedly handsome co-hosts, well, my one ruggedly handsome co-host, and then the handsome bitch, Katie and Will, the two of them.
I decided to film in my study today, which is why it looks a little better. This is where I normally work. I usually don't like to mix, you know, that my investment portfolio with this podcast, but today I decided to.
I was wondering if you're going to pull that joke. He's in his grandfather's office, everyone.
Which is why there's like weird Don Quixote art on there that you guys can't see. But yeah, we are here today. We are doing Iron Flame. And this is the sequel to Fourth Wing. I'm not even sure what to say to explain how bad this book is. Maria, do you want to give your opinions very shortly?
This book was rough. Reading it was at times like, so there's two things I want to say. You can tell that the author heard a lot of the criticism people levied at the first book and attempted to fix it here.
Which you can appreciate, you know?
I do. I will appreciate the attempt to do the thing. Unfortunately, and I heard some people on BookTok/Bookstagram making the comment that this book just feels worse written as far as the prose goes, which I didn't think was like, you know, a bar we would lower. But I would agree with that, especially in the beginning. And this book feels rushed as all get out. It, like, the first book didn't come out that long ago, and this book is even longer. So for this to have been produced in such a short time period, it needed so much editing. There is so much needless fluff. It tries to balance action and a school setting more, but fails to do so, where the school setting just kind of fades into the background too much, but they still try to keep it up. There's literally a point where we should just give it up, the entire pretense of a school setting, but they keep going for it. The book tries to have a bit more emotional stakes because the action is starting, and this is something that I argued for at the end of the last book, was that the action and point of the story, the true conflict, needed to come in much earlier, similar to how you've seen in we see in other school setting books, whether we go into whether those were like grand masterpieces or not. But there's a better balance, and this I think swung a little bit too hard in the other direction a little bit. And if Violet could have become more annoying, which I didn't think was possible, it did.
She did.
She's so, like, and there are people who are going to like her and like some of her struggles and stuff, but I find her very insufferable, especially the entire conflict with her and Zayden. Like, I was on his side for a lot of it, which is just bizarre given how much I disliked him as a character. But I found a lot of her points just needless and just unnecessary. It's rough. The sex scenes are worse. There was one that physically made me gag, like in the gym.
Which one was that one?
The throne sex scene.
It's so
the
gross.
Walls of her trembled against my tongue.
You know what's funny though?
Why is humanity bad at writing sex scenes?
You guys aren't gonna like what I have to say.
Oh God. Is this gonna be another ACOTAR situation?
Look, there's nothing, I would never reread this book. I don't think it's good. And yet, this is not the worst of the books that we've listened to for me. And it is engaged, despite how irritating things were. And I did fast forward in a few things because I just didn't feel like suffering it. But I was engaged. There were things constantly happening. So, like, I can't say it's still not, like, I could see how a 17-year-old on spring break would enjoy this book.
Unfortunately, that is not their target demographic.
So one thing I didn't realize about this podcast when we started is that it was going to strain me and Katie's relationship this much. It is hard sometimes to remain friends with people.
Is it weird that I liked the throne sex?
Yes.
I literally gagged in the gym.
It was so gross. It was so gross,
disgusting.
But it was so my woman. like, I don't like it like it. Like, it's not like I was like, oh my God, yes, throw me over a throne chair. But I'm like,
okay, so there are not words for how much I detest the characters in this book. There are a lot of problems in this book. The pacing isn't good. From what I understand, the writing is a problem. I didn't really notice it because it's audiobook. That's just a constant thing, is if the audiobook actor is pretty good, then you don't really notice prose as much in audiobooks. The world building is a mess. There's a problem with secondary characters not feeling like real people. But the thing that stands out to me the most, is how much I hate Violet and Zayden. My rage is not Patroclus level, okay? So there are limits. But man, did I detest listen. Like, it was just actively gross for me at a certain point, having to listen to them talk.
About the same fight. Over.
Oh, the my whole God. Time. The whole
and
time.
Over. And oh, like
it was exhausting. Fight. But see, again, that's one of my biggest pet peeves. One of my gigantic pet peeves is when a relationship would. I just personally don't like it. I don't think it's good. It's not engaging. I would rather them go fight about something else at least.
The other thing I'll say about this book is that there's a thing I do with books that I've noticed, which is, you know, like how in books, like when a really terrible traumatic thing is happening to characters, they'll be like, I went away on the inside. Yeah, that happens to me listening to these books, I've realized, in that my brain literally has to tamp down. Like, I have anger, and it boils out of me, and then I have to be like, no, suppress it, go down. It's a similar thing I do when I learn about existentially horrible things happening in the world. I just am like, you can't do anything about this, don't get mad about it. I have to do that with this one, and I kind of have to try to think of other things while I'm listening to the book.
Did you just equate this book to giving you basically PTSD, where you have to dissociate so that you can get through it?
Yeah, essentially I'm dissociating to try to get through this book. I think it's so bad. I mean, one book I'm going to compare this actually a lot to is Harry Potter, the first three. None of us like J.K. Rowling, but she's a much stronger writer than Yarrow's, and especially for the kind of school setting that this book has, a lot of the things she does correctly, this book does badly, so I'm going to be making some comparisons.
And again, we're using the first three. I think
also, could we compare it to A Deadly Education as well? Is that not like an equivalent, like, kind of like school deadly?
Does The Hill Behind Your House compare to Everest? I mean, these things are insurmountable.
I never got to read the rest of it, so I don't know how good it really is. Like, I only got to read that first one, which was really fun.
Basically, I will also just say that this book has no meat. This is a book about nothing, and that's one of the problems with it. Yarrow knows how to ape things other books do, but she doesn't understand why they do them. So when she does something, it's lacking in thematic weight because the book has nothing to say. It's not like all these fights between Zayden and Violet throughout the book actually amount to anything. They don't say anything thematically about, like, trust or openness. The War College being in a horrifically brutal place never goes anywhere. It doesn't mean anything. She just knows that, like, I watched that scene in Full Metal Jacket. And so that's kind of the problem with this book. We got a comment. We did a comment response live stream a couple days ago or a week ago. You can find that under the live tab, not the video tab on YouTube, because YouTube is weird. And one of the comments we had gotten was that they wish we spent less time nitpicking and more time talking about the meat of the story. And eventually, I think what we uncovered was that what they were talking about is they would have liked us to talk about, like, themes more of the book.
And like the researched background behind. I think the point I made was, like, how a video essay would approach.
And the problem that I don't think they realize is that we do that with the books that are good that we read, but we don't do that with the bad books because so much of what we're doing is remedial. And in this book, there is no meat to it. Like, it has the veneer. I think Katie used for the third ACOTAR book the description of an egg with only shell and no yolk. And that's very much this book. And it's just... And if this isn't your very specific FAP fantasy, then this book will not do it for you. And this is not my very specific FAP fantasy. And so I detested this book on so many levels that I'm becoming weirdly serious about it in this moment. I think it's the office behind me. I feel very intellectual right now.
It's elevating you.
That's the thing I realized the other day, is that I'm a public intellectual. We're public intellectuals. You know what I mean? Our job is to go out and tell people ideas, and they're supposed to, like, listen. Again, not a god, but a prophet, maybe.
So funnily enough, I think I've been trained for this my whole life, reading shitty books, because I have read so much fucking fan fiction Like, it's disgusting, like, so much. And through reading that fan fiction, sometimes I was really desperate. It's because, like, I really wanted to read a specific concept and nobody else was covering it except for this one person who could not write well. Or, you know, not that that was, like, a specific instance. That happened many times. So I would read these long, like, empty plot, like, da-da-da-da, all these relationship beats that are just repetitive. And that's why they became pet peeves. It's because I was waterboarded with it.
The other thing to note about this book is that, and people want us to note it, is that this book was published very quickly. And so some of the editions that people got had, like, this cover was wrong on it, or problems with the trimmings and stuff like that. Yeah, from what I understand. Yeah, and people, along with the fact that some of this writing was very poor, they're like, this needed to be edited more. And it did, but the editing that needed to be done was a flamethrower, so I'm not sure how much they would have actually liked that. So that's one thing to note, is that this book is, people have talked about how it's sort of like fast fashion in a certain way, and that this had really low turnaround time, and it led to poor quality. But, like, again, I don't see, this isn't like a book series that's good, so poor quality is a very variable term there. It could also be that some of it was pre-written. The first three Temeraire books came out very quickly after each other because they had all been written.
Oh,
I remember.
Yeah,
that's right. And so I'm assuming some of this had been written, and then she just accelerated the back half of it. The other thing that I mentioned that is that there's been some controversy about how the names in this book work, because a lot of them are Gaelic. And they are not pronounced even vaguely Gaelic. It's Gaelic, not Gaelic, apparently. And there was an Irish woman complaining about it on TikTok that I watched.
Whose name?
Everyone's. Tiernanoc, Asgaeth. I'm pronouncing them the way they are in the audiobook, which is not the correct one.
Tiernanoc in this.
Taryn's name is Tiernanoc.
Oh, that's right.
But it's pronounced like in
Gaelic. Oh, of course. It's freaking...
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense phonetically.
Asgaeth has a spelling. Like, so if you hear how it's said, like, so the names have an influence, but the pronunciation is not that. It's what she wanted.
That's fine. That is so, that's nitpicky.
That's what I thought for a minute. But the thing about it is that it would take so little time for her to, like, literally after the TikTok, I could pronounce them correctly, and that was like 60 to 70 seconds.
But what if she didn't want to?
Well, okay, so the point is that you should not be using another minority culture's names to add spice to your world without actually even pronouncing them correctly. It's kind of the way that anime will sometimes just use random English to seem cool and foreign, and like, it's not, and that's fine because English is just like, let's be real, it's kind of a slut language. But it's, in this case, they were very annoyed because their culture often is used, and their language is used to, like, add some spice to somebody else's world, and they're not even taking the time to pronounce it correctly. And the thing is, like, again, I was kind of like, this is a little frivolous, and then I was like, yeah, but it would be so frivolously easy to fix. She could take 60 to 70 seconds to pronounce these, to learn how to pronounce these words correctly.
But question, are we talking about the audiobook reader or the author? Because the author just wrote it.
The way the audiobook reader says it is the way the author says it.
Oh, I understand. Okay, I get that.
And so we're just going to throughout this be pronouncing it in the English way. Any overall thoughts, or you guys want to start on the plot? Because this is going to be long.
It was a painful book. I do think in some ways there are some things that are maybe better than the...
Redeeming?
I would not say redeeming. And any... Again, if Katie was able to enjoy parts of this, I was able to survive some parts while absolutely... clawing my eyes out for other parts. So, you know, some people are going to like this. I know because I've seen stuff that they already do, and that's fine. Like, again,
red flag.
I've said this before, like,
massive Chinese red flag waving in the wind.
We are not here to take your joy away, but we are a book review channel, and we're going to tell you what you think about it. And I did not like this book.
I'm here to raise the intellect of humanity, the consciousness of humanity. And so I will tell you all the things that are wrong about this book in the same way that you would after a plane crash look at it and go, what's in the black box? What happened? Let's make sure this never happens again.
I will be the tame medium side of things because...
Trashy. The trashy side of things.
No. I've just read so much worse. That this is not the worst. It's just not great. I don't know. It held my attention. There's something to say for that.
This is, by the way, before we get any farther, we have a Patreon, and you guys should go join. But if you guys don't have money for Patreon, what I would like you to do is like or comment on this video. I know that's a thing YouTubers say all the time, and it's annoying, but the way that the YouTube algorithm works right now is that people who see this video in their feed, it'll be shown to a few of our subscribers, and if they click on it and engage with it, like or comment, it will then send it to more of our subscribers who otherwise wouldn't get to see it, because nobody uses the subscribe tab on YouTube except me. And so it actually really does genuinely help the channel, even if you're not, you know, you can't afford the Patreon. So please do that. It is in the description below. Welcome to the Indie Ad Corner. Our sponsor today is The Dreams That Bind Us by Maximilian Lopez. Have you ever experienced a dream where everything was familiar, yet something seemed to be off? Perhaps you're living with someone else, doing the same job, but with a new set of colleagues. Maybe you have a different set of friends. Or maybe the events within the dream were slightly weird. Could it be that you are having a glimpse into another dimension where an alternate version of yourself made different life choices? How would you react if these dreams occurred and if they showed a darker side of you? Would you take lessons from those dreams or want to explore this other life? What if something or someone kept you from waking up? Our main characters begin with Celine, who is a perceptive, college-bound young woman that struggles to navigate her internal world. Adapting to a lifestyle in the Navy, Corey must forge his own path forward or face a troubled past. Joseph is a seasoned, award-winning actor who will abandon everything in pursuit of greater heights. Though their paths never crossed before, an event sparked their entangled destiny. They each shared a dream, a window linked to the same alternate universe. When our three main characters connect in person, they make a startling discovery. It's not just a dream, but an ability that throws them in direct contact with powerful forces that hold the answers they seek. With time running out and danger around every corner, they need to work together. But who will they trust? Strap in for a riveting, character-driven sci-fi thriller as dreams come alive and fate draws you ever closer toward its relentless grip in The Echoes of Ethereum series by Maximilian Lopez. Starting with book one, The Dreams That Bind Us, which is available from the online retailer of your choice, with the third in the series coming in summer of 2024. Now back to the video.
Okay, so the synopsis of Fourth Wing was, we're in a generic fantasy world, and they have an army military school. And then girl who was supposed to go to the scribe squadron of the army military school ends up going to the rider squadron where they ride dragons. And it's super terrible. We kill off a lot of our cadets and people. Even once they have dragons, you're allowed to kill other squads.
Even though people. By killing the cadet, the dragon may die. And they're short on dragons.
So this girl goes in and she's like, my mother is the general of the school and high up in the military. And then there's this guy and his name is Zayden Ryerson. And his father was the general of the rebellion that went against their country. And her, his dad died and her mom was part of it. So they hate each other. Ooh, they fall in love. She gets a dragon. She doesn't just get one dragon. Despite the fact that she is physically weaker, she has Eller Danlers?
EDS. We're gonna have to talk about that because
it doesn't get better in the second.
The representation gets worse.
Everyone, it's beyond worse. That's actually one of my biggest gripes about this book is that it randomly comes up but means nothing. And it's they still have like wildly like insane sex with no issues. Like how is she putting her legs up on a throne? And like, you know,
wraps. Like, apparently wraps are a magical thing that just makes all your joints better.
Her and obviously her and this guy, they do a heck and fallen in loves. And she gets not one. Again, she's weak. She's never trained to be a warrior. She doesn't know how to fight, really. She gets not one, but two dragons. One of which is an adolescent dragon, but nobody knows because nobody's ever seen an adolescent dragon, but it's small and very gold. And she gets like the biggest, baddest, the second biggest, baddest black dragon. And there's only two black dragons alive right now. And it's all like, ooh. And then she finds out after 90% of the book, you discover that actually the people that they've been fighting against this whole time, the Griffin Riders who live in Poor Emil, those aren't the actual enemy. The actual enemy are these Venon, which are weird sorcerer people that pull magic from the earth, not dragons, because I don't know, that makes it better. And they're evil and they resurrect. How do they make the Wyvern? I was thinking about this. Do they cobble together bodies? Because it's not like they reanimate dead dragons. There's these animated dragon creatures called Wyvern and they're heckin' evil. And they've been attacking with the Venon, the citizens of Poor Emil. But Navarre has been safe behind their wards, protected from the Venon and the Wyvern. And also pretending that these things don't exist so that nobody will go help the other people, even though the other people aren't evil. It's basically they were like, we protect our own and fuck everyone else outside. And so Violet hears about this and she's like, oh my God, Zayden, you knew about this whole time and you didn't tell me. And then they like have a battle. Two of her friends die. And at the end, she's like, how dare you keep all of this hidden? You're leading a whole rebellion and you didn't tell me. And your hometown that I thought was burned to the ground is actually alive. And sadness. And that's how the first book ends.
Even though they had only been together for several months.
Like 9 months at that point.
Oh, and her best friend was a mind reader. Let's not forget that's another reason he didn't tell her shit. That's fully valid and yet she'll get annoyed about.
But also, he is a rebel leader and like technically an inheritor king of,
and she is the daughter of the general.
Why would he open up about anything to her yet? She hasn't proven herself.
Yes, and so in this book she wakes up in the secret city that Zayden is actually the king of, but nobody mentions it till like about halfway through.
He's not a king, he's what, a duchy or whatever the heck.
He's the highest royalty in that area. And basically, this is her brother is there who she thought was dead, and he's a revolutionary. Don't worry. It will basically be like he's dead because he has no character throughout this entire book. He will just do things inexplicably. And she's like, Zayden, I understand why you lied, but unless you can tell me the truth about everything right now, we're donezo. And he's like, I can't tell you everything, but I'll tell you most of things. And she's like, no.
Yeah. How we can't be together. And here's the thing. She's asking for 100% honesty, okay? She still knows that she cannot ward herself because her friend Dane, who we haven't mentioned, but he was the fake, like, is there going to be a love triangle at the start of the first book? If he touches people, he can see memories of theirs. They know that, like, Dane is still going to be around. She can't ward against Dane. And he's like, yeah, no, I'm leading a revolution, Violet. I can't tell you. And also, in general, let me tell you something. Let me tell you something. Relationship advice from Maria. Nobody is entitled to 100%. Nobody. Keep 20% for yourself. There are things that you never, unless it is about that person and will literally affect that person, which is at one point he literally says, I will tell you the things that are relevant to you that you need to know that you not knowing would affect you. And she's still like, no, that's not good enough. Nobody is entitled to 100%.
Second pet peeve of the book that has been mentioned now. I cannot stand it. I cannot stand it when one character in a relationship, or any, it doesn't have to be romantic, but in particular romantic ones, where it's like, you need to tell me absolutely everything, or it's like an ultimatum. Again, ultimatums don't, like, there are certain ones that obviously are realistic and can work, like, don't cheat on me, or, you know, don't kill someone, but the...
And they shouldn't necessarily be ultimatums. They should be boundaries that you've placed, where if the person breaks that boundary, you do the right thing for you. The problem is trying to get somebody to adjust their behavior, because a boundary is something you set about what you will accept for yourself versus something where you're asking someone else. Because like, you don't have to put up the other person doing it, but if they're not going to stop, that's on you to walk away from the situation. You have to respect your own boundaries. An ultimatum is asking someone else to change and force their behavior on. And because like, it's one thing to be like, listen, if you do this, I will leave. But you just, that has to be the truth of it. It can't be like
You can't be trying to manipulate their behavior into it. The thing about it also is that you would think then that trust would become the theme of this book and the thing that their relationship...
But it's not.
Yeah. No, the thing their relationship should be about and grow to. But there is no understanding of what trust actually is on Yaris's part. Like, it really doesn't seem like she understands how that even works. She really is focused on how can I make this really hot but still unstable. She's trying to swerve from the second book problem of like, now it's boring that they're together because they got together at the end of the first book. So there has to be like a lot of drama. The other thing I need to talk about is... how gross Violet's gaze is on Zayden.
Oh my God.
There is not a sentence that goes by that does not talk about how insanely
hot he is.
Appearance-wise, it's constantly mentioned that he is incredibly hot and attractive to her. And she will talk about why she doesn't know why they're together. Why does it, but there's just this animal attraction that always works and he's always beautiful. And throughout the book, you'll be like, okay, but why do you actually like him? Like, you know, an example of this is in Kushiel. I forget what the guy's name is, but the male character, Roslyn, he is like
JJ.
Jocelyn. He is described as extremely beautiful. Like, he's very pretty, though everybody from that country is, but whatever. But, like, it's mentioned every once in a while, and there are actual reasons for the two characters to be in a relationship and things they find attractive about each other that aren't their appearance. That doesn't happen here. There's a problem in this book where a lot of the people, even the main characters, feel very hollow inside, and like, this is like that. She has to keep insisting that they're so attracted to each other because there's no other reason for them, for you as a reader, to feel that they are.
There's one part in particular where while I was running, I was listening to it, and it was towards the beginning where she's like, it's like way the beginning where she's like saying that same exact thing where she's like, we shouldn't be together, that kind of thing. And then she's like, but our physicality is perfect. We are a perfect match for sex. And then later, it's almost like she realized what she was doing for like 5 seconds of clarity, because she's like, and I like his personality. Like, it was mentioned afterwards, like an afterthought. And it was like, you guys don't even spend time together besides fucking.
They also don't have conversations that isn't about the conflict or their problems. Like, it's not like they have like routines as far as like the way they interact or inside jokes or like quirks that they admire. Like, what is a single quirk of Zayden's? Like, does he always like, when he's nervous, does he like always run his hands down his pants?
He has a knife in the armoire. That's his quirk.
But honestly, for him, it makes it like, you're in a war. It makes sense that there's a fucking knife in your armoire. I don't know why that was like a special scene. Like, yeah, there should be knives everywhere. But it's just like, what is a quirk about Zayden? Does he like, when he eats, does he like, or like when he works out, does he put a headband out so his like hair doesn't go into his eye? Like, what is anything that he does that makes him a unique whole person? Like, does he refuse to eat broccoli? Like, he's anti-vegetables, and everybody's like, you are literally the leader of a revolution. Eat your goddamn
vegetables. That'd be cute.
That would be so cute. Those kinds of small, because those are the humanizing details that bring life to a book, that make characters feel. And if you think about, I'm going to use Elle and Orion in Deadly Education. Orion had so many fucking quirks. That dude was a bag of quirks, but it humanized him from just being the guy who ran around saving people to this guy who had a bunch of like odd things that he did, to how like his inability to like notice things, his like single-mindedness, the way he ate, or like how he paid attention. And then like Elle as well had a lot of quirks. Even her friends had quirks that made them feel like actual humans.
And like, not just quirks, but just even just specificities. If you compare Zayden to, because Mia and Katie did a critique stream, which we do on our Patreon, subscribe, it's a good time, you can support independent journalism, of the first chapter of Scorpio Races. And the main character there, I was always really interested in how the author wrote them, because he's a very silent, stoic character, and yet there's a lot of personality there.
Oh my God, so much.
There's so much more. He is such a more specific person than Zayden, while still being that kind of archetype of the dark and brooding male.
That's a really wonderful point to make. Will and I only read part of the first chapter and part of, I guess you said, the third or something like that. And I felt more characterization for a character that literally said, I think, 3 sentences, 4 sentences.
Yeah, he doesn't talk at all.
And then I did this entire, and it's like, that writer is so good. Like, holy crap. Like, that entire, I'm in the process of reading it, but this book took over, you know, everything, as you all know. But it was, that was so good in comparison to this.
The thing about it is, one of the places I really noticed it was with Brennan, her brother. I don't know what's going on with Brennan. Like, there's all this stuff with their mom and their relationship with their mother, which we'll talk about how stupid this is later. But, like, he is like, he doesn't like their mom that much. And I was like, but why? Like, there's never a moment that really grounds you with the character. Another example of, like, quirk is, like, does Zayden like to make certain kinds of jokes? And the answer is no, because this is taking after ACOTAR, where everybody has the same kind of dumb, sassy lines. And so there's no specificity to how they talk.
He made a dick joke. He made one joke. He made a dick joke. And he likes chocolate cake. And he likes chocolate cake somehow. We know that. That's about it.
That's it. He makes a single solitary dick joke. He's sassy in how he talks. He likes sex.
Which everyone in this book does.
He's a nymphomaniac. Like, all he thinks about is sex. I mean, look,
it's rough.
The poor man, he's always hard in his leathers.
There's no post-nut clarity, and I feel bad for him because he would realize how toxic Violet was if he did. He needs a no-nut November. That's all I'm saying.
That's a huge problem with the book. It's just that there is no personality. So again, Violet's love of Zayden feels purely physical and animalistic. And it feels like by having their dragons be bonded and adding the, like, they get extra bondedness through the mating bond, it feels like
Alpha Omega.
A shorthand for their mates. They're together, they're like, they're chemically bonded is what it feels like. Mm-hmm.
It's never felt natural. It's always felt like, oh, since that has happened due to those dragons being together, they are now forced together and now they have to learn to love each other kind of thing.
And also, I don't buy why Zayden is in love with, because he talks about when he fell in love with her and how he fell in love with her before she fell in love with him, which as someone who read the first book, I don't buy it that he was in love with her. Like, there's nothing about, like, and it's not like he tells her, like, you did this thing. There was this one moment where you were doing a thing and you didn't realize anyone was watching you. And I saw you do this and I realized you had humanity. And that was the moment that I started seeing you as a person instead of seeing you as the general's daughter. There's no moment of that. Do you know how useful?
The tree moment. It should have been the tree moment. Like, yep. Right? Like, isn't that the go-to? Is like, that's the first little baby step on, not where he falls in love, but the first little baby step of, this person's a pretty cool person.
Yeah, but for him to narrate, especially because he has, we find something out about him that'll, like, elevate some of this. Not elevate it, but, like, explain some of this. But, like, if he had told her, like, it was in that tree moment, realizing you weren't going to snitch despite being the general's daughter, that I realized you weren't this evil person and that I'd built up an image of you in my head and I could start seeing you as a human for the first time, that's a humanizing moment. But, like, he only mentions it when this whole thing, we find out what his second signet is, which we'll get into. And it's more just like, and that's how I knew you weren't gonna snitch on us. And it wasn't like, that was the moment I realized you were a human, like the rest of us. Like,
or I saw how intrepid you were and that attracted me to you or something like
that. Or that you were so determined that, like, everyone, and if he's had a moment where he was like, I also was like, why the fuck is she here? And then you just kept.
That's a great thing to bring up. It's like, it was built in for her and it didn't get taken advantage of.
Tell us why they love each other besides the fact that Zayden is hot and she has been, like, all wiggly down there since this first moment she saw him.
Lindbergh has a really good description of it. She says, they are like jellyfish helplessly grinding each other in the middle of the ocean, brainless. And that is such a good description. The other way the author tries to trick you into thinking they actually like each other is that they, like, touch each other's faces and touch each other's backs. But if you take out those intimate touches, there is no intellectual romance there. It has been said on this podcast by some that me and Maria are monster boyfriend aficionados. And one of the things that works about monster boyfriend, which is the, for the record, this is not hot werewolf, this is monster boyfriend. So they have to be unattractive when the falling in love happens, is it is a romance of the mind. It is intellectually and emotionally why do these two characters love and need each other. And that is utterly missing from this book. And she says it again in the text, she says it, but it's like, you can't hang a lampshade on it and still expect us to realize it's not a lampshade. Oh, by the way, one of the people in the chat had mentioned that Zayden is supposed to be POC, a person of color.
Is he really?
I don't know. There's a lot of description of people with rich brown skin in this book, and I just didn't even pay attention to it at a certain point. And if that's true, that's actually a little bit troubling. Not that I think the author is one way or another, but it contributes to a stereotype of brown men as virile but somewhat dangerous. Valerie says he was tawny once in the first book. And then Thea says she said it in an interview. Or if Italian stereotype is POC. Actually, Italian parasite would have been a POC at one point.
Shut up! Some of these images are ridiculous!
You can share your screen, you know.
Bro, like, can we just appreciate, like...
It's so stupid looking.
Look how, like... Wait, let me go. I just love the sexy, like, smolder.
God, I fucking
look
can't.
At the Taxi Smolders. Oh yeah, that one. Wing leader. Rebel faction. Bad guy at War College. Oh, that one. Strut it, Vogue. They're in love. They're in love. This is
the worst.
In that photo, go back, Katie.
The pouty
like
one.
No. There's this one where he looks like one of the. Oh, go back down. The next one. He looks like one of the. Oh God, what is that? That group of three brothers that sang.
Oh, Jonas song. Brothers.
The he Jonas looks like brothers. A Jonas.
He looks like a Joe bro. Like, oh, look at that. I can have a sweatshirt that says Zayden Ryerson is the standard.
You know, I've literally thought about putting on like Tinder. Like, I run a book podcast, and if you like Akatar, swipe left. I'd be like, I'm more of a Tamlin than a
sticker.
Yeah, their romance doesn't get better if you were waiting for that. And if you were happy with their romance in the first book, you're probably going to be fine with it here, unless you dislike arguing over the same thing over and over and you understand the fundamental silliness of wanting 100% honesty about everything, even stuff that doesn't have to do with you, and not just honesty, like if you ask a question you want an honest answer, but like just wanting to be told everything all the time. Maggie says, please don't ban me, I'm Italian. Oh, it's because she's
I don't. This chick's dragon keeps stepping on my meat balls. It would be a gabagool.
Dying.
I mean, look, honestly, Tony is more attractive than Zayden. There, I said it. We all know it to be true. Zayden and Violet are a very specific kind of pairing that women really like, that I'll talk about more later, that I just don't like. I don't like bitchy boys. I just don't like bitchy high maintenance boys. I had been making a joke, and we're far enough in the video that people will get this. I have been making a joke now for all week and 2 weeks now that I think we need to go back to shaming women for their libidos if this is the product of it. I think women's suffrage led to all of our suffrage at this point. This actually does lead into a real point, kind of, which is that part of the problem with this book is that it is not erotica. If this was erotica, okay, this is your kink. It's going to be weird to people who aren't into
it. It was Ice Planet Barbarians.
Yes.
Oh, it's so forgivable.
We did not complain about this with Ice Planet Barbarians. That book is like, it is straightforwardly has a pregnancy kink, which not all of us are into.
Did I enjoy that? And did it make me highly uncomfortable? Yes. But at, like, there was a scene. in that book. Where two characters angry masturbate at each other. Like, out of spite.
Yeah, it was. That was funny.
Are they two men?
No, it's a woman who was caught masturbating, and then she was like angry. She was like, "I'm not gonna stop." And so he does it, and the both of them are like,
"This is hilarious! Oh my god!"
But that's the point. The book doesn't take itself seriously. So as much as you're like, these are how some things where this could be improved, that was just like you're on a roller coaster. And you're just there for the ride, and like you might be laughing and gagging at a couple points. But like you
know what it was,
and it's unapologetic. Yeah. It's not trying to present itself as like a whirlwind high fantasy romance. It's not trying to be like the plot of
political
that is
stakes.
Also, yeah, there's not political stakes. They're not world ending stakes. The one book where there is kind of like, wow, things might get ugly, it is immediately resolved very quickly by like one woman being like, I'm gonna fuck with this ship. So like, It's all very low stakes, and the sex and the weirdness is like center stage, and you're like, oh no, this is her, versus this book where I'm like, why are we pretending this is goals? Why are we pretending? And frankly, I find the Men of Ice Planet Barbarians less problematic.
Mm-hmm. Infinitely. Ooh. So.
There's even one guy who kidnaps another lady.
That happens several times. Getting back to it, one of the things that's hard to do about books like this is that, because some people are going to make the argument, well, look, how do you know that this book is for everyone? Maybe it just did just want to do something on its own and isn't meant to be taken seriously. So there are certain ways in the narrative to contextualize what's going on as being for a specific type of reader or not. It is a difficult thing when books don't want to be for all audiences. There's no way in, though actually that's not true. A lot of books nowadays that are like self-published and stuff will have like, this is a dark mafia romance. Don't read this if you don't want X, Y, and Z. So extra textual material will let you know sometimes what kind of a book it is and whether you're supposed to engage with it and what level of reality you're supposed to engage with it on. And then also, you know, the genre. Some genres are more like this than others. And then if it's fanfic, there's actual tags that will tell you. But in this book, this is a mass audience book. It's sort of YA, which has a much stronger, I think, responsibility to label itself clearly. And this is not labeled as erotica. There's just three or four really awful erotica scenes in this book and a really unhealthy main relationship.
I watched this really fantastic video by Obviously Queer, and it was, "Is TV and TikTok Killing the Slow Burn?" And the idea was that book talk and Instagram books, like the way we talk about books, is they say, if you like this trope, and what it is the taking of fan fiction tropes to be the basis that books are built around. So you don't go into a book just being like, oh, this is a romance book, let me go, and then go, oh, it's enemies to lovers, that's what's happening here. You go in knowing it's going to be enemies to lovers, it's going to be a slow burn. This is how the books are being marketed and are being sold. So for instance, this book, when people talked about it, were sold as an enemies to lovers. I would argue it was never really an enemies to lovers.
Not even close.
Books are being written. And so, like, books that are technically not slow burns, as I would like to think about them, or like Katie or Will, as people who read fan fiction, would consider a slow burn, where it takes, like, what would be the equivalent of multiple books in a fan fiction format. That's a slow burn versus, like, a slow burn, which just means that they don't kiss or they don't have sex until 75% way through the book. That is like what the TikTok and book talk community is now defining slow burn as. And so these books are being written with tropes in mind, because the tropes are what are selling. When you have books that are being marketed and written around tropes, it functions where there is no tension. If you go into a book knowing it's going to be a slow burn, you're going in with, there's no, because that means all, because one of the best parts of a slow burn, and Obviously Queer talks about this in the video, is that the things keeping them from being able to be together or being able to fully explore their feelings is the good part. It is why it cannot work immediately that makes a slow burn work really well. And if you know it's a slow burn, there is no anticipation. You know it's going to, and if you know it's enemies to lovers, you're just waiting.
It's like the new trailers for all the movies, right? There are so many trailers that legitimately give you everything in it. And it's like, I don't want to see the movie anymore.
Yes. And unfortunately, we are marketing, advertising, and buying books around fan fiction tropes. Yeah, I mean, think about this book. It literally opens with what if it wasn't like a it's less a trigger warning section than it is the tags when you go to a fan fiction, and it's like it has this and this and this and this and this and this, and if you don't like this, don't read this. You know, books are being marketed that way now. Books are being written from this, and this felt like, I'm going to write a fantasy book with smut, with an enemies to lovers romance.
It's the commodification of literature into something that can be sold a la carte or whatever it's called. Real world, like, marketing versus art is always kind of an interesting thing, and it's not necessarily a combative relationship. I think everyone would argue that the economic limitations of special effects made Star Wars better, and then when George Lucas had all the money and could do his real artistic vision, it actually was worse. So sometimes there is a interplay between art and commerce that will actually make the art better, but in this case it's leading to just cheapness, like, and it's leading to just like, I want this thing so I'm gonna eat it now, but it's now we're getting, you know, fast order instead of fulfilling meal.
So that's why when every now and again you find an author who's truly in it for like the, oh, I'm an artist and I have to have it perfect,
or just, this is the story I want to tell. This is.
But you could argue that is also what, to some degree, some people are still doing, even though they're publishing. It is a story they want to tell, but they're not patient enough to tell it.
A lot of people are also just going from the tropes. They're like going in like, this is the trope I'm going to use in the story, and that is what I'm talking, versus this is the story and it just so happened to have some of these tropes, but it didn't, like, that's, and it just, the whole point both of you were saying about the fastness of it, that's what happened with Yaros here, where Forthwing created such a buzz and it was marketed so beautifully, it had such hype around it, that to capitalize on that, they had to get the second one out as quickly as possible. And it just, it makes such a difference. She talks to her brother, who, again, she thought has been dead for the past 6 years. She's pissed because he's actually alive and has been working in the revolution. He is really happy to see her. She's pissed. Her and Zayden are basically like, we're not together anymore. Because he, again, like we said, he's like, I will tell you ask me questions. I will answer what I can, but I can't promise I'll tell you anything. I'm literally leading a revolution. And she's like, no, we're not together. So then there's this discussion of what do they do now? Do they go back to Biscayeth? Because they're in Arisha, and it's Zayden's home that had been burnt to the ground, apparently, but it's now a thriving city again. And they're there, and there's the people who lead with Zayden the revolution, and they're like, what are we going to do with these, like, cadets from Biscayeth? And basically it's decided they need to go back to Biscayeth so that people don't start looking for them, find Arisha. Like, what's going to be the best way to keep this under wraps? So they go back, they create a story of where they've been, because the whole reason they were in this situation was because at the end of your first year, you have war games, which is where you and your squad you do fake war games against other squads, and it's supposed to help prep you for battle. And during theirs, they ended up getting attacked by Wyvern. They had to take her to Arisha for healing, the whole nine yards. So they're like, okay, we have to go back. And like, Zayden's also supposed to be graduating this year. So they go back, they tell a story. And the only person who really knows what happens was Dane's father, Colonel Eidos. So they like go up against Eidos. Violet's mom chooses to believe her daughter about what happened. And they go back to school. Zayden graduates and he gets stationed very far away in Samara. And basically they're told that originally they're supposed to be able to see each other every 3-4 days because their dragons are mated and mated pairs. And this is something I hated. In the first book, the entire time they're like, you guys are never going to be able to be apart from each other more than 3 or 4 days for the benefit of your dragons. And then in this book, everybody's like, nope, once a week, buddies. Like, and they specifically make it so that the dragons sometimes only get, because Samara is a 12-hour flight, and they're only given 2 days, so they have to fly 24 hours, and so they only have 24 hours for the dragon to be there. And like, why did you make this a thing that has to happen if it's so easily cast aside? And there's a lot of things that happen in this book where you're like, it was established in the first book that it wasn't supposed to work this way.
Yaros herself mentioned this as a story device in the first one. Why mention it even remotely as an issue if it's not going to actually be? Not as if, like, oh, there's no reason why they're, like, split apart. They're, you know, actively being acted against by many people. It's just, why even use it as a excuse/comment in the plot, you know, in the construction of the story itself?
There's a lot of other things, such as, like, dragons don't listen to humans, and there's a couple points where, like, they do because, of, like, and then, like, the book goes back on itself. There's a lot of little things where, like, stuff that was established in the first book is much more flexible in the second book, but not as, like, oh, we didn't know this. Actually, it works this way. We're discovering it together. It's not that. It's just, like,
this was inconvenient to the story I wanted to tell, so I'm changing it, is kind of the vibe.
She goes back to school. He fucks off. They get a couple of weeks, like 2 weeks, where there's nothing really going on because it's summer break and they're waiting for the new first years to come in, which is the, you know, you walk across parapet. And so they have to do it. And one of the people that comes across parapet is Sloane, who is Liam, who Liam was like good boy golden retriever guy, Liam's sister. And Liam's dead. And Sloane, in Liam's dying moments, he asked Violet to take care of his sister and help her. And so she's trying to do that, but Sloane hates her because she knows that Liam died because of Violet. How does she know that?
I don't know. That's the one thing I kept asking myself the whole time. I was like, how does she know that Violet's involved in the scene of the death, even if she was around, so were many other people. Why did somebody say that he died in Violet's place?
But also, how do they know that piece, but they don't know that Zayden basically made him swear to do that, and it's actually Zayden's fault that he was in the position? Or that, I don't know, do you know your brother and know that he's a good guy, and if he was friends with someone, he would just try to save it? Like, it's just a really dumb...
Yeah, that should be... it should be a testament that, oh, my brother loved you enough as a friend
to save your life.
If he was that important to you, then you're that important to me.
What would have been better is if they had where she comes in and she's not mad at Violet, but she knows that her brother gave his life to save her, and she's not mad, but she's a little distant, and then they become friends, and then she finds out it was Zayden's fault that Zayden made him swear to do this, and she gets mad at Zayden because of this, and not necessarily at Violet. And then they can process that together where she eventually goes, I don't know why I'm even, like, you guys were friends. Of course he would have done that for you. Like, that could have been a nice, like, evolution of it. But again, it feels very forced and artificial because, again, why would she know? And how would she not know that it was Zayden who, like, how does she know that, but she doesn't know that Zayden's the one who made, like, it makes no sense. Anyway, the new first years come in. Violet's decided she's not going to get to know any of the first years. Oh, another thing that doesn't come to any sort of fruition in this book at all, but someone else comes across Parapet this year, and it is the king of this world, the king of Navarre's youngest son.
Hey, he was a good plot device, okay?
Yeah, he's purely, I thought something was gonna happen with this in the latter half of the book. Nothing happens. He comes in, he doesn't want anyone to know he is literally a prince of the realm, so he just pretends his name is Auric. He gives a fake last name. The only people who know that he is the prince of the realm is Violet and Dane, because they literally grew up.
Justinia, too.
She realizes it once they meet at the certain point. But anyway, and so he's here, and they're like, okay, well, because his older brother came to the quadrant as well previously and died, so his father wouldn't want him to be here, but he's like, fuck my dad, I'm the rebel prince.
Favorite character, honestly. He stuck his hands and burned them.
He was wasted.
Yeah, like, what the point was he?
And also, I just hated the, like, how convincing him to do this thing, like, because there's so much complexity you can have with a character who is literally the prince of the realm and then chooses to betray. Like, why was there not a moment where everybody realized what he had done and then his father gotten, like, that's such a juicy plot. Like, that's such
so good. It is so good. I thought there, man, let me just tell you, I would have, like, oh, there's so many, I just see so much potential in some little baby things. Not enough for me to be like, oh, I really want to write this, but, like, enough where I'm like, God damn it.
Again, it's all hollow. So this whole book should be like a meditation on trust and loyalty. Because who is he loyal to? Is he loyal to his father? Is he loyal to the realm? Is he loyal to his own wants and needs? And then later, when all of them kind of fuck off to be rebels, there's also no grappling with the cost of it. What does it mean that he left his father? What's the emotional fallout? Once they're all traitors, what does that mean? Do their families feel disappointed in them? None of that stuff will ever go anywhere. And that's what I mean when I say that the book is about nothing. It's about nothing. The conflict between the Imperium and the rest of the places, like, she knows that, like, oh, in Divergent, the culture there wasn't good, and so they had to, like, rebel, but they had, like, a caste system or whatever. But she never actually defines what the Imperium is like, or why it is the way it is, or what does that mean?
The other thing with Auric, nobody at the end, when they're, like, all, like, the generals are all there, and Auric, like, nobody's like, Prince, you're there. Like, it's so annoying. Anyway,
I know.
Her mom is literally in the room with them, and she's not like, Your Royal Highness, what are you doing?
Fuck my life. When that didn't happen, I gave up. I actually, that was actually the point where I stopped listening to it. And I was like, Maria can tell me what happens next. because I was like, I'm not going to rush to try to finish this for the sake of that entire mistake.
They go to school. Sloane doesn't like her. She misses Zayden, but she's angry at Zayden. And school is fine. There's a new guy who's running the school, because, like, Colonel Atos gets kind of kicked off of being in charge of the school because he did a bad. And so then they get someone else in, and it's this guy named Varish, and he is just mustache twirling Dolores Umbridge of a person.
Oh my God, but what, like, a great comparison.
At least Dolores Umbridge was, like, looked cute in it. Like, there was that, like, that.
Yes, disparity. No, there was that. Yeah, that contrast.
But not here. And also, so during when the first years or first cadets, and they're doing that thing where the dragons all sit around and roar at the cadets to see who runs, Varish's dragon, like, smokes some people that were alive. And basically what is going to happen throughout the first third of this book is Varish is here on Atos's orders to try kill all of the people who saw the Wyvern and the Venon. So anyone who was in their squad during war games and went to Athmene and got attacked by the Wyvern and the Venon, because now they know they're real, even though they were all traitors.
Can I just mention, also, it would have been so easy. I mean, there's so many ways, I guess, you could have done it, but wouldn't it have just made more sense for them to send that group on a mission of some sort? Or literally, if they could, or better yet, they were being kidnapped for Nav and for torture, like, practice. Why wouldn't they have just grabbed all of them and imprisoned them and tortured for them and information like they did Violet? Well, I don't understand why none of that happened. Realistically, they would have been nabbed up. None of them would have been there. and they would have all been like tortured until they got all the information and then killed. It's so mustache twirly.
I think what the book tries to make its reasoning as, I won't say that this is great reasoning, but because they convinced Thorngale's mama that what happened was just they got attacked by Griffin, so everybody else at the school besides Varish and Dane's papa doesn't know that they now know this information. And also, they don't need to torture them for information. The reason they tortured Violet was because they
found... No. But that's what I mean, is literally they all, like, it's presumed that they have now been involved in some way in, like, some deeper thing. So if they wanted information, like, they wanted information from Violet, they could have just tortured them. Or, again, nonetheless, why assassinate them in ridiculously complex ways? Just grab and bag them. They're a military, for the love of God. I'm sure, like, they have black ops, basically.
You're right. There's no reason, especially because they smuggled infantry in to get Violet at that one point. Also, what was the whole point of making Violet... We'll get there. Anyway, continuing. Anyone who was at Aspen and got attacked by the Wyverns are now going to be tried to be picked off. And some of them are second years, some of them are third years. And one of the classes that happens this year is interrogation and navigation class, which is a secret class that nobody knows about before you get into your second year. And it's basically, we're gonna put you in the wilderness and have you, like, naked and afraid it to try and navigate your way back. And also, we're going to torture you. It's like when people are in Navy SEALs or mm-hmm. the Army, especially like the like the elite, like an Army Ranger, where you have to get prisoner of war training and all of that. It's like that, but like you don't know when it's gonna happen, and we'll just like nab you and take you. And the teacher for that class is actually kind of fine, but Varish is involved, so he's just a butt face.
So here's the thing: two things about that. One is that there are like three or four scenes devoted to this idea of them having to work with the infantry when they get nabbed to go naked and afraid or naked and alive or in the wild or whatever the thing is called. These scenes go nowhere. We never need to know anything about the infantry.
Or the healers.
Yeah, or the healers. It goes nowhere. It's like a world-building tidbit that she just decided to put in the book for no reason. And the other thing is, this does not even feel vaguely like a medieval world or anything like that. They call it the infantry. At one point, they start talking about the artillery, and it's never defined what they're talking about. Like, they don't have guns. What is what's the artillery doing? Is this a mage artillery? Like, it just doesn't...
Do they have giant crossbows that they launch into the... Like, what are we doing here?
Again, she should have just put this in the modern day. I don't know why she didn't. And the other thing is that the torture side of it also makes no sense, because how often are they going to be captured? Like, again, it's kind of like she read about the Navy SEALs and was like, I'm going to do that. But it actually doesn't make any sense for the setting.
And it also doesn't, because are the torture devices, like the level of torture they're doing. So you're expecting that Griffin Riders are the enemy. So if they're training people against Griffin Riders, because again, Navarre has no plans to deal with Wyvern or Venon, which are the actual bad guys of this story. The Venon have magic, but none of the Venon's magic works within the wards of Navarre. So this is something I need to explain. Navarre has a giant ward stone that is in Basgaeth, and the wards protect everything inside it so that Venon, Wyvern cannot come in, Griffin Riders cannot use their magic within the wards, and they have a bunch of like posts outside of the wards that kind of extend the reach of the wards. Okay. Because they have the wards, they never expect to like deal with Venon or like, so there's no training. Nobody knows they exist. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows Wyvern exists. There's no training. Like, the Griffin Riders are so easy to kill. At literally at one point, somebody's like, how did two dragons get taken down by a drift of griffins? How is that even possible? And I'm like, why is this such an intense war college when you mm-hmm. literally, the only people you are fighting against are the Griffin Riders, who all they're doing is coming and attacking some villages, but mainly to get supplies to help themselves. That is it. Why is it this intense? And also, like if your dragon wasn't, like, because one of the things they do is they give them a potion to make it so their dragons can't communicate with them anymore. Are Griffin Riders gonna have that? Like, are they gonna do it? Your dragon can tell where you are, So if you have access to your dragon and you're being held as a prisoner of war in a griffin stronghold, I'm sorry, you don't need prisoner of war training. There's no, it's like elephants are so outside of their babies, they're so strong, they don't have to fear the other, like especially in the herds led by the matriarchs, they don't have to fear
Predators.
predators. They don't have none. They're just too big and too bad. And they, with their babies, they just put them in the middle. It is like if you had an elephant training to fight against a lion as if it was an impala.
It's really weird.
Let's say Sawyer, one of Violet's friends, gets kidnapped by a bunch of griffin riders, right? And they're torturing him in the camp. All he has to do is be like, yo, my dragon, whose name I don't know, come save me. The dragon comes in, stomp, 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 stomp. You're done. And if the dragon's dead, you're dead.
Side note, that was one thing I was going to bring up later on, but you just said it. Why don't we get to know anybody else's dragons in a dragon world? I
Oh
wanted to
God.
know.
This book has nothing to do with dragons. Dragons are in it, but they can't talk to other people. None of the dragons are real people. Taranak, Violet's dragon is kind of has the problem that Zayden and Brennan have and all of the other characters where like they have he has a countenance, but he doesn't really have a personality. Like he's just grumpy all the time, but like why does he do what he does? Why does he really like Violet that much? How do they bond? How do him and Violet decide what they're gonna do? Like that's kind of just mostly he's just grumpy about things a lot. Why does he feel strongly about the Wyvern? Who does he feel he should protect? Why is he the way? What does he like about Sigale, the other dragon he's in love with? He is not a real person in the same way that Zayden is not a real person. There's nothing under the surface that we learn about him besides he's grumpy a lot. Like he doesn't have strong feelings on anything. And again, it's such a wasted opportunity. Go read Temeraire. There are so many ways to build themes and relationships through the dragons in those books. This book is not even interested in doing that. There's one point later where they're gonna meet a bunch of griffin riders and interact with them. The griffin riders have the exact same relationship with their griffins that the dragon riders do with theirs. And so it's not like the book is trying to say something like the way that Temeraire did with the culture's different relationship with the dragons. Like they don't treat the griffins like property, which would tell you something about how, you know, again, she's not trying to say anything, so she can't say anything through the themes, but it could speak to the themes if they wanted to.
The idea that dragons don't talk, they only talk to their riders, it makes it so that every other dragon is just like a cardboard cutout, like moving in the background, except for maybe Sigale, but even then, not a ton of interaction. Anyway, so they have this class, they're gonna get tortured. And again, there's also, Will mentioned it, they have a point where they meet up with a, they have a squad of infantry, a squad of healers, and a scribe, like a couple scribes who come with them, and they're like, this is what it's supposed to be when you actually go out to war, this is what you're gonna be working with. And like, I was like, oh, so we're gonna have these characters and they're going to be along for this ride. And I thought it was going to be a joining of, no, it, as Will said, it goes nowhere. It's very frustrating because I actually liked the idea of getting to know these other squadrons. And also for them to be like, the infantry to be like, no, we don't do that shit. Why on earth would you do that? And being like, oh, the riders are just fucked. And you get a little bit of that with the griffin riders. But even then, I'm like, what are we doing here? What is also happening during this is Violet is realizing that the scribes have literally wiped out because she keeps trying to find information and she can't find anything older than like 400 years. And all of it has been translated because one of the things you learn in this book that you didn't learn in the first book is that all of Navarre used to be a bunch of little smaller nations that had their own languages, own cultures, and own customs that all got crushed underneath the boot of unification. There's literally a weird class where this one lady is like, what have we lost? Like, we've gained a lot, but what have we lost? And what you realize is that all the books, even that were in other languages, were translated into Navarian, but Violet quickly points out that that's impossible. There was tons of books, and they only like had like how long did they do this for? So obviously a lot has been lost. But she realizes that books have to be being hid because there is a specific thing that she's trying to work on, which is she discovered when she was in Orisha that they have a ward stone there, and so if they can figure out how to raise the wards in Orisha, then they will be able to protect more people and protect some of the Paromish civilians, and it'll help them fight the war. So she's trying to figure out how the first six riders, and they weren't actually the first six riders, they're just called the six, but like how those guys raised the wards at Bas-Gaiath. And so she's trying to find it, but nothing exists. So she realizes that we're being lied to.
Like Will was saying before, how the theme of this book should have been truth and lies. What a lovely counterpart to that, or what could have been a lovely counterpart to that, where it's like interpretation of truths through translation. You know what I mean?
There should have been way more moments where she realized that something had been translated in their textbooks. Something like, especially when she was learning, when she ends up in Orisha and she's learning their version of history and just realizing, oh, this was a translational era. That would have been so cool. Like, but anyway, she ends up realizing this. She goes to her friend Jacinia, who is a scribe, and she's like, I'm gonna trust you. Because Jacinia is like, listen, I'm realizing that some stuff is going on in the scribes quadrant, and I'm a little nervous about it. And like, Jacinia is kind of dropping hints, like, hey, I think something's fucked up. And Violet's like, wow, that's real weird. Maybe this other thing is fucked up. Until the two of them are finally like, okay, we're gonna work together to figure out what's happening. And so Jacinia starts helping her. Her and Zayden are going back and forth and seeing each other. Like, he comes to see her, and then the next week she'll go and fly to see him. And they're arguing a lot and not having sex because, like, they're not together. And he's like, I'm not gonna do anything with you until you say you love me. And she's like, because, like, she's at a point where she would have sex with him. And he's like, no, I cannot just have sex with you unemotionally. And she's like, I was the one saying that to you last year. And he was like, well, I guess I'm the Violet now. And it's just so annoying.
So this is a good time to mention that one of the problems with this book and Zayden and Violet is that it wants to be a kind of romance that she then doesn't want to actually write. So, well, okay, so the problem is that this really should be, and I think it was Ben or Science Fantastic on our Discord that mentioned it, talking about how the archetype of this kind of a romance is like alpha male, dark hero, and like young ingenue woman.
Ingenue?
What does that mean?
A young, beautiful woman. Innocent. Like Christine Daae in The Phantom of the Opera is the young ingenue.
And so, like, this book is very careful. Like, she's not a virgin. She's had lots of sex, guys, for real, because they know that's the feminist thing to do. But it's still the type of pairing. But the problem is that she also knows Yaros wants to write that kind of a pairing, but she also knows that's not feminist. So she's going to try to make it so that Zayden isn't. So she's trying to pair Zayden as like extremely possessive and dark, and like a bad boy, but at the same time, like respecting Violet. And the two don't really play nice a lot. And so that's why this whole like, oh, he really wants her, but like, oh, you have to ask for it kind of thing is kind of stupid. Zayden at certain points will come off like a real sociopath because she wants him to be so,
oh my god, I know,
possessive. At one point he's like, yeah, why don't we just leave everybody? She's like, you would really leave everyone for me? And he's like, you're my everything, you're my gravity. She's the one who says gravity.
And it's crazy because in the first book he's like, I can't love anyone enough, I have to put the revolution first. And
which
you're like,
makes way more sense.
That's fantastic. And character,
it's the what do I call it, the it's the Cullen effect, the Edward Cullen effect. Where, like, once you find your quote-unquote mate, nobody else matters. And it just, like,
there's a thing that we've been sold in modern romance that when you find your person, they are the other half of you, and you put them above everyone else.
But that's not realism.
It's not. And also, the idea that you need, like, there's a comedian that has a great skit about this. His, I'm blanking on his name. Sloss, Daniel Sloss, thank you.
There you go, Daniel, yes. Sloss.
But in his second thing, he talks about how, like, if people are puzzle pieces, we've been told,
oh my god, what a
the
great
center
piece.
Of our puzzle, the center of our happiness. So ugh. There's a puzzle that, so like, we have to have, like, community, we have to have a job, we have to have a calm, we have to have hobbies, all these things come together to make us a whole happy human. And we've been sold that the center of our puzzle piece, of our puzzle, is someone else. It is our romantic other half. And he realized that that's not it for him. The center of his puzzle is more so what he does and his calling, and that if he's with someone, it's a nice extra puzzle piece, but it is not the make or break.
He also clarifies that some people do have that as their major, yes, puzzle piece, like his father. His father and his mother, the comedian, explains that his father and mother, their central puzzle pieces seem very much so like each other, but he doesn't have that.
And that, unfortunately, we've been sold that love only works in that way, where the person is supposed to be the other half of yourself. And I think it's really ridiculous as a concept, but this book plays into that.
I get that people want to read that as a fantasy too, that overburning, again, women really like that overpassionate burning romance or whatever, but it dilutes the character. One of the things I always remember about the Savior's Champion, take a, well, actually, no, don't take a shot. Kitty, you're safe. You can function the rest of today. Is that there's one point where the main character is going to die and he like or thinks he's going to die. And he's like, this girl I met 3 days ago, you're my everything. You're the wonder of my life, whatever, whatever. And I was like, what about your mom and sister who have been in this book? Like, you should want that. You should be thinking of them. It would have endeared me so much more to you if you had thought of them in that moment than this rando girl you met 3 days ago.
Some total of 4 interactions with.
The thing is, this is not a book that's supposed to be, like, characters in books are supposed to be kind of real, and they don't feel real if they act as though the other person is their only point in life. It just makes them a little pathetic, really, and that it doesn't help the fantasy. And the other thing is, like, there are ways to write other characters as central. Deadly Education, and like the third book, the main character, she has a lot of trouble when she can't find Orion, her love interest, and like you get that, like, yeah, they are central to each other's lives, but she's not just thinking of him all the time.
And her going to rescue him is not at the expense of everything else in history. There's literally a point where she realizes something in that book, and she has to, like, she asks him to stay, but she can't make him. Like, it just, oh god.
The thing that is really frustrating when you do read a book that's like this, it's kind of like getting high, right? Like, it seems like it's like an instant for those who enjoy it, right? It's an instant, like, oh yeah, it pressed my good button. And I feel really good about it because, like, in this moment, it feels really all-encompassing and comforting. But really, at the end of the day, like, unfortunately, that makes the characters quite hollow for in and of themselves. And it reflects, like, my personal life when I read something like that. And if I'm reading about a character that's hollow and they're just in there for the love, that when I'm finished reading with it, I have not really quite been inspired by anything. And that lack of inspiration, like, not that I need that from every book I read, but when I don't feel the inspiration of the character's intellect or the character's bravery or the character's caring nature or something like that, then it all just feels very like I wasted my time in a certain way. And I feel kind of sad and like I've wasted my time a little bit. It's in this case, a lot, because I had lots of other things I wanted to read, like Scorpio Races, and I could not this week because of this very long-winded book. And so when you walk out of a plot and you didn't have characters that fulfilled themselves, it feels almost like you are unfulfilled, at least so long as that lingers in your memory.
Lindbergh has been saying, you know, I found it very triggering. This book should have a TW for mental and emotional abuse. So one of the things about that whole, like, overriding love over your own morals is that is kind of how abusers think, even though I don't know how much Zayden and Violet actually fall into that dynamic. But that's kind of the thing, is when you only love the person and don't care about being a good person otherwise, it can lead to really bad behavior. And I think there's actually a way to write this kind of thing if it's contextualized properly. Like, and also if you're okay with writing something a little bit dark and fucked up. So for example, like if, you know, Zayden had never been ever close to anyone in his life, and everything had been kind of a wash, and he'd always been a traitor, and like there had been nothing for him, and then Violet came in and was the only person that cared about him, then yeah, it kind of makes sense that he acts more in this possessive sort of way. But it's not shown that. In the first book, it was shown he's a leader of the Marked Ones, the rebel kids.
He has friends.
He has quite a number of people who love and trust him.
So I'd like to posit a TV show that did this exact thing, but like in the right way, where there's a character, it's called Never Have I Ever, and the main character ends up falling for, like, having a huge crush, and it ends up working out between her and this, like, hottie bad boy. And at first she's like, he's misunderstood, and he, like, how she first interacts with him really is he thought he was trying to write stupid bitch on one of the teacher's cars, but accidentally did her car instead. And the entire time, but like, he's super good looking and he's great in bed. And she's like, wow, my sexual awakening, because she's a senior in high school. And her friends are like, oh no, he's hot garbage. You enjoy his body, but when you're done, like, this is not a man. And she's like, no, he's just, you don't know him. And then there's a point where she has a bad experience with this one adult, and he steals that lady's wallet. And she goes, oh no, you aren't a bad boy. You're just a bad guy. Like, you're just, and she like, she has to be like, thank you. For all the orgasms, basically. She doesn't say this, but basically, like, thank you for the orgasms. And he's like, are you breaking up with me? And she goes, sweet Ethan, goodbye, and like leaves. And I'm like, yes, that's how you handle that. Like, that's the interaction. It was great. I loved it.
And the thing is, like, I do get the fantasy of it, but you need to more clearly mark your fantasies as FAP material. Going all the way back to what I was saying about the ingenue thing of it, this book, again, it wants to have possessive male an ingenue woman, but it also realizes that, like, they need to trust each other, or like the feminist thing would be if he trusted her to make her decisions. So that was very much the dynamic in the book before, and in last book was like, oh, Dane's such the patriarchy, he's trying to like keep her from dying, but he won't let her make her own decisions. And in this book they switch it around so that like Zayden is like that, like, half the time. He's like, oh my gosh, you went and did a thing without me. And they have arguments about that a lot.
Where he's like, no, I won't let you do this thing. And she's like, you sound like Dane. And he's like, well, I didn't love you before. And it's like, well, Dane also loved me, and you shat on him because he wouldn't let me do this stuff.
And the thing is, this would be okay, but it doesn't go anywhere. It's not like the last moment in this book, like the big pinnacle moment, is him learning to let go and trust her and communicate with her, or learning that he can't be possessive. It's okay to have flaws so long as they are addressed by the narrative, and it is not addressed here. Because again, this book is not about anything.
Oh, no, there is a point. It's literally a passing line where he's like, so there's the whole thing where she tries to go to Corden with him to that one guy that has the luminary. And after that, because she goes anyway, he's like, I've learned from Corden, I won't say no, you do what you want. But it's like a passing line. And then from that point forward, he's like, I don't want you to do that, but I'll let you do it. So like the book deals with it, but not in a like overarching character arc.
I missed it then, yeah.
It's tiny. It's a tiny thing where after she goes to Corden and he realizes she's not going to listen to me, I can't bully her into not doing, or like beg her to not do stuff. He does have that moment, but it would have worked better towards the end and had it been more explicit and not just a line, and been a big lesson moment. And it could have kind of complemented where she goes, okay, I'm going to trust you even if you don't tell me everything, which does not actually fucking happen. For her to have that moment and him to have that moment, and then it be like a thing, but no. That's not what we get. They're doing stuff. She's helping Sloane not suck, even though Sloane doesn't want to listen to her. And then she ends up, problem is her squad, which is Ree, Sawyer, and Riddick. And then there's this other girl who, like, at the beginning gets her neck snapped very quickly during someone trying to...
That really sucked, because she was actually in the first book for a hot second. Like, you know, you got a little bit of her, and she was just like, yeah, I'm sore, and Gale, snip.
The idea is there are people trying to kill the guys that were at Athmene, and so someone tries to kill Violet, and her friend pretends to be her and gets her neck snapped. But so all of that is happening. She's in school, she's doing stuff, she's also learning, like, her and Zayden are talking and arguing.
This whole time she's having to be like, oh, I can't tell Rhiannon the truth and my friends the truth, and that's really difficult for me. And like, oh, I don't know. And this should be a contrast where she has to learn and deal with what Zayden does, and like make or not make the same choices, again, using themes of trust and lies and truth. But that really never happens. The most that could be said is that later she lets them in and it's not a problem. So theoretically, it could be that she found that her friends are her strength instead of a weakness, and that could have gone somewhere, but it really doesn't. This book also has a thing where like certain plot lines will just kind of stop. So it like happens for like 10 chapters, and then she tells them and nothing really comes from it. The other thing is, during this period, there's a point where she talks with Rhiannon about what happened with Liam and how she's traumatized from that, and also how it's good that the college is as tough on them as it is, and as brutal and ruthless, because then that makes them harder and tougher. And this goes back to the author not having anything to really say about the War College or the Imperium. It's not like, oh, this is a clue that this is a really fascist, gross imperial state. No, the author really does seem to think it's okay that they're this murderous all the time. There will be some very like contrast with the Griffins later, who are like, you guys are just weirdly like lethal. But it's not like Violet has her viewpoint challenged by them at any point, and she learns that, like, hey, this is why this is bad. And then there's also stuff about like she never like thinks like, oh, maybe it's not good that I've become hardened to these things, or like, and even her grieving for Liam is very like She says she's sad for him, but it's not as though she's hollow because she's been taught she can't have these emotions and then they come out.
Basically, the plan for the revolution is they have a forge, but they need a luminary because the alloy that they use to make the weapons that kill Venon needs to be heated to such a point that they can't just have the forge powered by dragonfire. They have to have this luminary to make it even higher. And this guy, who's a Peromish royalty person, is like, "Ooh, I want to see Violet use lightning." And Zayden's like, "No, he collects people. You can't do it." And so while they're trying to get the luminary and work on that, Violet decides that she knows there's a wardstone in Arisha. So she's going to try, like I mentioned before, figure out how to get the wards working so that she can do that. And she's working with her friend Jasenia in the library to do that. So she ends up asking her friends to do this thing with her where they realize she was talking to, no, who was it? Sawyer heard her mom. So when she finally confesses everything to all her friends, like, "Hey, this is what's happening. They're Wyvern, blah, blah, blah." And she confesses this to everything. And she's like, "I'm trying to get the, figure out how to raise the wards, like the first six does." And Sawyer's like, "Well, there's the two diaries that are in the secret chamber of the archives." Cause Jasenia has been looking everywhere. And you're like, how the fuck does Sawyer know that the school? And he was like, "Oh, remember last year when we busted into your mom's office and stole her map off the wall? I just so happened to read a missive on her desk that detailed this." Number one, these books have been here for years. Like, literally years. Like, 600 years. These books have been locked up in Vesgaya's vault. Why was there just a missive laying on her desk?
Much better way to explain it. His parents were one of the nobles that came by and were shown the books.
Yes, that would make so much more sense if he was of nobility. Because I'll explain this part later. But it's the dumbest plot contrivance to make something work. And basically, there's a secret in the archives. There's secret places, and that's where these two journals of the original six are hidden. That should hopefully have some details. And this is like, you really hope that the journals weren't just like romantic doodlings, you know, like they actually had, because like, you know, there's people who have their work journals and then their personal journals. It would have been hysterical if one was just like mainly like other stuff and random, but no, that's not what happens. But anyway, so they're like, Jasenia ends up finding out where the secret place is and they have to bust in, baby. And so they like, Zayden comes and they're using him and it's like five of them go in. And they have to go, and they need Auric, because one of the things that the archives, the little secret room is that it's only able to be accessed by someone of the royal bloodline, because it's the king's personal archive room, and where he takes people to look at stuff. And so they have to get Auric in on the thing, which requires, like, telling Auric everything, blah, blah, blah. So they bring him in, they go in, and he takes Violet in with him. Also, Auric and Zayden don't like each other. This goes nowhere. It gets resolved very quickly. So anyway, they have to bust in. He takes Violet in. They're looking through everything. And there's also a time limit. They have an hour where the archive is empty before the archive gets sealed, because every night for 12 hours, the archive is like hermetically sealed off to the point where like all the air's out of it and you will die if you are in there. And so they have an hour to do this, and they're like racing against the clock, and eventually they find it, but it's in a place like it's behind another ward. And when he reaches in to get it, it makes his hands bust out in like gross blisters and stuff. But they get the two books. They run off. He gets healed. Her and Zayden go, and they're like, "Dude, oh, I suppose I have to mention something that happened earlier than this."
Oh my god, we're not even halfway through the book. We're not at part two yet.
There's this guy named Nolan who has been a healer. He gets mentioned in the first book. He's been healing Violet like her entire life, and he is really exhausted this year. Like, just fucking wrecked this entire year. And people are like, "Oh, they must be using Nolan for torture, blah, blah, blah." Nope. He was resurrecting Jack Barlow for some reason. Now, Jack Barlow was this nemesis at the school. It was basically the Draco Malfoy of the first book. But Violet killed him. She struck lightning on a mountain and brought down an entire mountain face on this guy. He should be not just dead, but smushed goo dead, you know? No, they resurrected him. He is alive, and now he's being allowed back at school. And he's like, he's all like, I'm helping first year study. I'm not being an asshole to everyone like I was last year. And there's literally a point where he saves Violet's life. And the point that I don't like about this is, what's the point? what's the point in there? Mm-hmm. The idea is Jack is trying to gain Violet's trust. He literally saves her life and is like, hey, you know, when I died, I saw Malik and it changes a person. I'm trying to be better, which means he's trying to gain Violet's trust, which means he should be doing that for a specific reason.
But there's no reason.
There's no reason.
We're almost at 2 hours. So here's what I think we should do. I think I should run through the plot in 6 minutes and then we can talk about any of the issues that we want.
Oh my God, for the love of God, please.
So here's what happens. They get the book. They figure out like, hey, it's the... It's the diary of the original founders. And then what happens is that Violet gets captured by Dolores and she gets tortured as part, like, and she's tortured for like 6 days. And then Zayden
not just
really
tortured, but mended and then tortured and then mended and then tortured. So it's really extreme.
Yeah, while Liam is talking to her in a dream. And then Zayden is really pissed about this. So he drops dead wyverns all over the country to show them, like, hey, to disrupt everything. And he breaks in and he breaks into the torch room that killed Dolores. And then they're like, okay, we got to run. But Violet's like, no, we got to tell everyone, give them the choice to give the right fight. So they make a school assembly. They tell everyone. Everyone is just like immediately believes them. And then also is
no,
like,
no, they needed Katie, their Katie, dragons. They needed their
Katie,
dragons.
Katie. 6 minutes. And so they go, okay, yeah, the dragons tell the other dragons and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe it. So they almost all decide to leave. It's never going to come up that they're now essentially traitors. They're never really going to have to deal with that. Dane also is the one who Dolores wanted to break Violet's mind, but he doesn't. And he helps them get out. Okay. Now they fly to the secret kingdom where Zayden is. And we'll get to that part in a minute. And then I know, but we have to go through the overall plot and then we can fill in the details. I know, but like that's the problem.
Just two seconds, you commenting on me saying that is taking longer. Go.
Exactly. We'll just throw in some random points if you miss it. Just keep going though. Bulldoze through it.
All right. So they get to the secret kingdom place. Everyone's like, oh my gosh, what are we gonna do now? They decide to still just do school, essentially. And then there's basically Violet and Zayden are fighting this whole time and it's stupid. They try to raise the wards here, but they can't. Something goes wrong. And then they're
also,
like, okay.
All the Griffin Riders now have to live with them.
Not yet. So they're like, okay, we have to go to this Marquis guy who's been wanting to see Violet, but he likes to keep and collect things. And Zayden this whole time has been like, no, you can't have a choice, even though he respects her choices. She goes, he's like, all right, fine. I guess I'm not going to try to do this from now on. At the Marquis place, he has her kill one of the Wyvern...
Venom.
She kills him with like lightning and then they're like, okay, you can have the rune stone, but you have to take our griffins too. This whole time also we get introduced to a character called Kat, who was the ex of Zayden. She is the daughter of the Marquis guy and they had been married for a marriage alliance. She is unironically the evil hot ex trope that's just extremely sexist. I don't know why she exists. They take all the griffins back. The griffins then have to do to school with them. It doesn't really matter. There's not that much cultural clash. Okay.
William, I thought Kat would be your favorite character considering
I like no one in
both
this book.
Hot and bitchy.
I tried. I don't like anyone in this book. Okay, some more stuff happens. They decide that, oh, the Venon are gonna attack the old school, Basgaiath. We have to go back there and help out. And so they go back, and they're like, okay, we gotta help. This is the only chance. There's all this stuff about, like, wards and stuff. And then there is a final battle where the Wyvern are attacking because Jack Barlow, surprise, when he came back to life, came back evil. So he destroyed one of the wards. Wait.
Was he evil? Like, so this is something, finish and I'll ask this. Go.
Right. He had destroyed the wards. So now the Venon are all going to come and the Wyvern are going to come. And there's like a big battle. And this whole time, all of a sudden, Violet realizes she mistranslated one of the words. They don't just need blood, they need dragons. And not only do they need dragons, someone's calling me. I don't know. You two are the only people who call me. No, it's not. And they need the 7 dragon houses, but there's only 6. And then it ends up Andarna is a special kind of dragon. She's the last of her line. And we figure out that she only hatched for Violet because she wanted somebody who was a writer, but with the mind of a sage. So then, but they can only raise this runestone in one place. So they decide to raise it here because they can kill a bunch of them all at once. Violet goes to do it, but she can't have the power. So she's burning out. She's burning out. And then her mom comes in and pushes her away and sacrifices herself so she can open the stone thing. And that kills all of the Wyvern and the Venon. But then...
not all. It doesn't kill the Venon. The Venon run away.
Continue. The Venon are kind of lame. And then she goes to see Zayden, and Zayden's like, I killed him this whole time. He'd been wanting me. And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. That was a thing you said that then didn't go anywhere. Oh, also, we figured out that Zayden can read minds. He has two signets, and he can read intentions. And she was very betrayed by this. It was a very, oh, no, you're a smuggler moment from Cyborg dead. Tinkerer. Yeah, everybody thinks he should be dead because of that. And here we find out that now... he's a Venon. He had to use his power to kill the other Venon. Oh no, he has bloodshot eyes. And then at the end of the book,
literally
he's like,
the dumbest. Literally the fucking dumbest.
He goes to Jack Barlow and is like, how do I get rid of this? And he's like, you can't. You're one of us, bro. And that's the book.
I can't describe. No. I mean it. Like, it makes me so fucking angry. It, look, if the story were written well and there was that little twist, maybe that would be cool because then I could rely on an author to be able to do like something cool with it. But all I know that's gonna happen is more like guilt, misery, sex, angry, I'm becoming evil sex.
Man, I am weirdly tired out. I think the best compliment I got is Lindbergh said, honestly, Will's tunnel vision plot recap is more enjoyable than reading the book. You're welcome. Okay, Maria, what did I miss of importance?
There's the whole idea that her mother is her, and this is such a dumb thing, because in the first book, I made the point, like, if you want to kill your daughter, just kill your daughter, because that's how she's painted to us. And here we discover that actually the reason she sent Violet into the Writer's Quadrant was because she knew if Violet became a scribe, because the only people who kind of overall know about the truth of the situation are the upper tier scribes, because they have access to the history, and that Violet would have become an upper tier scribe. And once she discovered the Wyvern and the Venon, she would have been like, no, I cannot do this. And she would have gone away. And so her mom was like, no, I cannot have you killed like that. So I'm going to force you to become a writer. Which would have made sense if in the beginning she was like, listen, I know you really want to be a scribe, but you're meant to be a writer. I believe in you. You can do this, instead of a, we'll see if you survive. And like, no explanation, no nothing. Just like, she literally, her mom feels like a sociopath in the beginning. But now it's like, I did it for you. I couldn't, like,
I'm least angry about that.
There's an attempt to make the dynamic between the siblings and the mom make sense, and it doesn't. The thing about it, and one of the things I'm going to compare this to is Harry Potter. Harry Potter is actually in the first three books. Again, we're not talking about the later books, and J.K. Rowling is a bad person. Okay. The thing about it is that the secondary characters will often have like their own plots going on, and there will be some depth to their relationships with each other. And that's one of the things that I hate about this book, is everybody warps to, Wet Dream, the main characters, essentially, like the marquee guy I talked about. At one point, Zayden is like strangling him with shadows, and he's just pathetic because that's the most wish fulfillment thing in that moment. That wouldn't happen in other books, because in other books everybody thinks they're the main character of their story. They're real people. They would try to maintain some dignity even as they were going to die, but that doesn't happen here. So the mother is an attempt to try to make them seem a little bit more real, but there's nothing under the surface there.
This whole thing is in service towards what happens in the end, which is when her mom sacrifices herself to save everyone. And it's like Brennan, she discovers Brennan is alive. She's the only one who doesn't get mad at Brennan when Mira finds out Mira is Violet's sister, that Brennan's alive, everybody's pissed. But the emotional like core of the end of the book is not actually Violet and whatever the fuck is happening with Zayden, but it's the fact that Violet's mom sacrifices herself because Violet was going to completely drain herself, but not Taryn. And this makes no sense because she acknowledges that unless she drained Taryn, she wouldn't have enough energy to fully power this. So like, why?
There's so many little things that like, it seems like Yarrow set up and it could have been well executed, but none of it is. And one of the things, like you're saying here, is the mom thing. Like, why, how satisfying would it have been if we had a Bleach ending for her where she came back together with Zayden at some point and it was Zayden and her who fought against something? And like, if she's gonna have to sacrifice herself for Zayden, both because of Violet and because it's for the greater good, because maybe Zayden needs to stay alive, but also in a way to atone for the sins that she has committed against him. Like, what a wonderful sacrifice in comparison to just like, oh yeah, let me just drain my dragon, who probably didn't agree with me, soul.
And we don't understand why she does it. We don't really understand why her and her siblings have this relationship with their mother. You know, I didn't watch it, but Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Lindsay Ellis in a video essay talked about how there's a really interesting relationship between the main character and his fathers, and how like one of his fathers sacrifices for him, but that doesn't make him good. It doesn't take away what happened, and it's a complex thing. There's no complexity here. There's no complexity to Violet's mother, and there's no complexity to their relationship, and honestly there's no complexity to her siblings. I don't know what Brennan is like outside of like the three things he does.
The problem for me is it just isn't laid out well enough that all of her decisions have been, because there's also a point where she's like, Violet's like, you didn't want me because you don't respect scribes. And her mother's like, fuck you. The love of my life was a scribe. And I'm like, where is more of that? Because like, even in the first book, she talks about how much her mom loved her dad. But like, her mother is not humanized to us, is never like, her mom tries to save her, like, as much as Zayden busts in. So, like, Dane initially saves her from Farish. Then Zayden busts in and saves them to get them out of the situation. And then her mom is there, so triple saving. And her mom lets her go. And her mom allow, like, same with her sister, lets her, once she's educated, make her own decision. And it just, she's not humanized enough besides just, my goal is to make sure my kids live. And so I have accepted the terrible truth of my country to make sure my kids are safe, even though I know if my kids find out about this, they would absolutely, because of how me and my husband raised them, would do something else. And so it doesn't make sense. How, like, if you're gonna raise your kids to be that way, like, and you're gonna let your husband influence them in this way where you're gonna have kids that would make decisions that they would do the opposite of what you yourself are doing, number one, why did you raise your kids that way? Like, why? And number two, it doesn't feel like in the first book, it doesn't feel at all like her mother is emotionally invested. And listen,
no, not at all.
And because it's not like what Will's saying, where you have a character who is just a bad character. What they try to do is they try to spin her mom as, actually, I just love my kids a lot, versus like in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, where like the other character, he's not redeemed, he's not made a good person by it.
He has grown enough that in that particular moment of character, like the moment to shine as a character, he shines as a character, but that does not redeem any of his past abuses. Like, he abused the fuck out of Peter.
But it also just makes no sense. Why didn't they get more writers? They had a ton of injured writers who were physically injured, but magically perfectly fine. Why didn't they have cart them in, bring them in on Griffin back, just get all of them in there? And even if her mom almost died, there's no reason that the only way to do this, like, what if they just partially drained 8 riders? If one rider and one dragon could superpower that fucking ward stone, why? It just doesn't make sense.
It's not about logic, Maria. It's not about logic. We all have to conclude at the end of the day, Yaros can't tie her threads together in a tie.
This
in a bow.
Is the problem with romanticism.
It cheapens the death. And the idea, the thing is, I made the argument that I wanted the mom, her mom, relationship with her mom to be more nuanced from the beginning. I wanted more depth. And because of how she did this, it has, because I like that as an ending for her mother. I like the idea of her doing something to sacrifice herself.
Me too.
And to not just, I need my kids to leave, but I need to do something, like you said, to redeem myself from my past actions. And it's just such a failure, and it feels so unnecessary that it just, like, ugh.
There could have been so much complexity and interestingness there. We're always here for complex relationships.
I should have cried.
Maria didn't cry. All right, so I have two major issues I want to talk about. Which ones do you guys have? Mine is about the Griffins and Clash of Cultures, and then the EDS.
Okay, you take that. I was going to talk about the bad buildup with Zayden, his power, and the whole him becoming an Avenan at the end. I'll do that.
While you're talking, I'll think about it.
Okay, so at one point they have to have the dragons come through and the Griffin Riders come over and help them. And this should be a Clash of Cultures. Take a shot, like in A Song of Ice and Fire, the Night's Watch has to help out the wildlings. They've been spent a bunch of like years and years and years defending from the wildlings, but there's a greater darkness in the distance that the main character, Jon Snow, knows is coming, and they need to work together. But people in the Night's Watch don't really believe him, and they don't like it. And again, they've spent so much time fighting these people. And the thing is that when Jon Snow spends time with the wildlings, his viewpoint on the world is changed. There's an actually very different culture there, and they have different roles. They're much more democratic, for example, but they also have trouble getting anything done because of that. And eventually, and it speaks to the themes of the book of overcoming petty human squabbles against a darker force. And then eventually, you know, some of the people on his side end up killing him because they just can't deal with this clash of cultures. And that is how that should go. How it goes in this book is that the Griffins are a little different. And the Griffin riders are a little different, and Kat is very bitchy to Violet. And that's basically it. It again goes back to this book is not about anything.
That's a really good point to make. It's because that's actually something I was actively thinking about once they traveled with them, is that we never got any of the Griffins' personalities or any interpretations of their personalities that would endear us to them. Or like, there are so many opportunities where there's some cute, quirky, like pauses, or there were pauses where cute, quirky moments could have happened and it didn't happen. But also, you're right. Like, They're throwing punches against each other. Sure, yeah, but what I was expecting to happen also was there for to be for because it's highlighted at one point where Mateus or somebody died, and all of the writers were like, oh my god, and they started breaking down crying, and Violet actively is like, wow, they are a lot more emotional about this loss than we are, and I thought that was going to come up as a fault at one point, as well as a strength, both in the strength where she notices it as like, oh, they're feeling for each other. This is the way things should be. We shouldn't be sociopaths. But then simultaneously, I thought it was going to come up as this is weakening your resolve or your perspective, and it's getting in the way of it. But it never does, even though it really seems set up for it.
It doesn't say anything about either. And it really should with how she's been dealing with Liam's death.
They feel culturally, and again, they've been isolated for 600 years. They've been living behind their borders. Their culture should feel different outside of the way we do threshing, which is how you get your griffin versus your dragon, is way more humane. And you don't feel like they don't like, it's not like, you know, what they eat is different, and we're dealing with that. Again, there are ways to humanize people and bring different cultural markers to make it feel like these two groups that need to work together despite fighting. And it doesn't work as well as it should.
We should have gotten what's her face, Kat, complaining that there were no showers for herself and shit. Like, they had pools and shit at their place, and Violet actively is like, oh my god, everything's so aesthetically pleasing to the eye and nice and pleasurable. Like, we should have had the opposite side of that, of Kat being like, yo, you bitches are so savage.
That should be the opposite. So let me make an argument. One side is perfectly protected within their ward and safe. The other side is actively being attacked by Venon and Wyvern. Why is the lush, beautiful architecture stuff in the war-torn place, but the place that has been safe for the past 600 years is still militaristic and acting as if they are in an active giant combat? Like, she should have... I understand Biscayas, the school, not looking like that, but there is no reason on this green earth that the palaces and places she has been at other points, because she's traveled a lot, shouldn't have even more beautiful, because people are cushy. Like, the royalty and the people on the ground, the civilians of Navarre should be soft and cushy, baby. They have literally the worst thing that happens is some griffin riders come up and like peck at shit. The people getting attacked by Venon and giant dragon wyvern, they should be way more fucked up.
There's no world building done, and because there's nothing she wants to say through the cultures. Again, in with the wildlings, Martin wants to say certain things about like ruling, the democracy, that kind of a thing. She doesn't have anything to say like that. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was the EDS, which is the disability that Violet has. I will say that because of all the comments on our last video, I now actually know a lot about EDS, weirdly enough, for something that I'd never heard of before. In the last book, we talked about how there was a toxic positivity trope going on, which is just the you have a disability and that's okay as long as you push through it. You work through it, you white knuckle it, you grit down. Just work harder, disabled person. If you work hard enough, person on a wheelchair, you can walk. Work hard enough, person who's blind, and you can see. This is a damaging thing because in real life, that's not how this works. And specifically EDS, we had one of the comments explaining, is a condition where if you push yourself, you may be able to do it in that moment, but then you're going to deal with like 3 weeks of blowback for pushing yourself too hard. It's a disability that forces you to reckon with your, you know, with not being able to push through. And that's actually really fascinating and really interesting. And nothing is done with it in this book. Again, it's almost not mentioned. She just keeps mentioning that she has wraps that keep her hinges from breaking, joints from breaking at certain points. And the thing is, it's really insulting because the author only wants it for window dressing. And at one part, Andarna, her younger dragon, which is a pointless character, it's shown that she's going to have trouble flying. Flying is going to be difficult, and B, she'll never have a rider, which would actually be really interesting to grapple with if it weren't for the fact that Violet has another dragon. It would be interesting to be like, oh, I'm going to bond with a dragon who won't ever be able to carry me, or something like that. Or if Violet then had to help Andarna learn to live with this disability. Like, what does it mean? How do I deal with it? How do you think about yourself? That could have been a great way of the two of them bonding and to talk about that topic, and it's not there. She literally, I don't even really think it's mentioned. It's just window dressing.
I will make the argument that I think she shouldn't be bonded with Terran. She should have just been bonded with Andarna. And it should have been about how, despite the fact that physically she cannot do those same things that everyone else does, her power, lightning, she doesn't need to be in the middle of the battle. In fact, it would be better if she's just somewhere high and she can just pick people off as they come once they're farther away. Like, she's, you know, like in wars, you have the archers would come at first before like the armies actually hit together. And they just rain arrows down on each other. That is her purpose. That is how she should be used. So ideally, her and Darna should be like, how are we still useful? How do we still, how can we still have a place and a function here that is fulfilling to us and the needs of those around us without having to just have Violet white knuckle her way through mm-hmm. everything?
Miss Ally Snow has got it. Like Hiccup and Toothless with the tail leg scenario.
Oh, yeah. I know that reference.
I really wish that it had just been that, and that she did have to reckon with the fact that, like, okay, your dragon can't carry you. What is, how do you do this? How can you, what are the creative ways you can deal with the situation? And also the idea that, like, being a fighter, being a warrior, being someone that is, like, it doesn't just have to be, like, are you physically strong? Are you a good tactician?
You have value outside of what society tells you. This would also tie into stuff about the Imperium. Like, you know, maybe they do the whole Spartan, let's kill the child thing. Very quickly, Limbrick says it's toxic perseverance is the one I'm thinking of.
Yes, yes. Toxic perseverance.
And it's, she also says, it's sad and disappointing from an author who actually has EDS. So one thing I've learned in this podcast is that own voices is a really stupid concept. People who have a thing are not necessarily good at writing a thing. And I would normally say that it's okay for, how to put this? I get that you get to write what you want. So maybe this is a fantasy for her or something like that, a power fantasy, but that's not how people will read it. This book will be ingested by mostly people who don't have EDS or a disability. And then therefore they will take those talks of perseverance tropes into how they deal with disabled people. And that's damaging. One of the books me and Maria are reading is we're rereading The Keys to the Kingdom by Garth Nix. And one of the things interesting about that is that the main character has pretty severe asthma. And that is something he has to deal with throughout the book. And it says something. Like, so when he's in the other realm, the house, which you guys don't know what that is, but he doesn't have it because it's a magical realm. But then when he comes into our realm, he does. And then if he doesn't have one of the magical items, he'll have it again. And it's one of these things where, like, it feels like a thing he has to function with, not a thing he can just, like, at certain points he tries to run and, like, he flops down and almost dies because it just doesn't, or there is a hard limit that you hit. And it also plays into themes of, like, he doesn't want to lose his humanity, like, and his asthma is one of those things he would lose if he became more of a denizen and less of a human. It's not done here.
Can I make the point about my issues with Zayden and his stuff?
Indeed, I am done.
So my big problem is there's two revelations that happen with Zayden in this book. One, that he is an intrinsic, which is something we learned about in the first book, which is if you can read other people's mind. And for some reason, you are killed if this is an ability you have, even though Zayden notes that he can turn it on and off, like he doesn't have to use it all the time. Just like, and I don't understand in world logic wise why Dane can exist and is just fine, even though he can not only touch people and sift through their memories, not just the memories you show him, but he can just sift through your memories. That's okay. But Zayden isn't. And because when she finds out he's a, because there's this whole thing where if you bond a dragon that was bonded to someone in your direct family line, you will either go crazy or you get a second
signet. Why is that the case? Anyway,
it's, like, it's that's so dumb. It's just so random. Like, yeah, like, listen, Violet getting two signets because she has two dragons makes sense. You getting two, like, I didn't like that. But anyway, so there's this idea that if people found out Zayden was an Intrinsic, that he would be killed, and, like, old Violet is absolutely horrified by it. And I don't understand the difference between the treatment of Dane's and this, because again, he can turn it on and off, and it is like Dane can touch people and he gets it and he doesn't even have to try. It just like comes. So it just feels so convoluted and like a thing to create issues. And it is also something that you don't feel from Zayden. In this book, she tried to make it like retcon where she was like, oh, you know, Zayden, he has a really good judge of character. So when he starts talking to someone, and then she's like, he's like, well, actually, that's how I know if people can be trusted or not, because I can see their intentions. And there's also this dumb thing where he doesn't actually read minds. He just can see intentions, which I'm okay with if it was described better. He knows too much detail. Because if you can just see someone has good intentions or someone has bad intentions, that's like intentions. But like, how do you know that they wanted a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? They like there's a level of specificity he gets, and it just feels really hollow, and it gets dealt with very quickly. And again, if there was a better reason for why intrinsics were such a bad thing, it would make more sense. But the real shitty part of this is that because of how this book is written, there is a big moment where Zayden says, I had to break the sage. So the sage has been in Violet's mind this whole book. She keeps having nightmares where he is talking to her and torturing her. But towards the end of the book, Zayden says, I had to break his hold on me. He has a hold on me, because there's a point where they're not being attacked. The sage is there and they're like, why isn't he attacking? And Zayden turns to Violet and goes, he's waiting for me. And you're like, why the fuck is he waiting for you? I thought he was waiting for Violet. So this entire book, it's been set up that the what's his face, the evil guy, is come in for Violet. A bunch of every time a Venon saw Violet, they were like, oh, you are the one the master wants. I shall bring you to him, and he shall reward me above all the others. And now all of a sudden, out of nowhere, at the end of the book, and this is a problem Yaros has, that I mentioned in the first book, where like an important plot point that should have been hinted at explicitly earlier, and not even explicitly, but just hinted at earlier, comes in the last fucking moments of the book. Because you're sitting there like, I didn't know Zayden had any relationship to this Venon. Mm-hmm. And it becomes big because that is how he ends up becoming a Venon, because this guy has him and has got him like wrapped in magical ropes and like being held down and is like, I told you you would turn for love and I was right. And because like the Venon kept saying to the sage, kept telling Violet, you will turn for a greater price than most.
Ever since the first nightmare was described, I've been holding out for something fun to do with that. Like my one little minuscule little ray of light in the cell way below the dungeons, even deeper than the dungeons, all the way into the oubliette. Like, all I've seen is that one little ray of light of, like, what's the sage want with her? Is there something cool that's gonna happen? And, like, that's not a twist I want her to know. If she ever somehow magically stumbles upon this video, that is not a plot twist. That is called, like, random insertion of an idea that was not foreshadowed or like built up upon at all. That makes
any sense.
I wanted Violet to become, if anything, a Venon or kidnapped. That's fine with me. I'm not cool with Zayden suddenly becoming the all-important one.
That's the fucking setup of it, is that she's the one that he has been talking to about turning into a Venon. And it's not even like, listen, if we were getting described on the nights when Violet doesn't have nightmares, Zayden was having intense nightmares and she was waking him up from that, because at this point they've been living together. Because then you're laying there's some groundwork. Or if he mentions, like, when she's like, I can't get the sage's face, and he's like, he is terrifying. Like, moments like that, like, just where they could have that, and it's hinted at that this is a thing that's happening, but no, the guy's always been after Zayden. It was Zayden he wants. Give me one sec, I have to plug in my thing. It's dying and I'm so angry. I thought I'd make it the whole video.
You know what's really funny?
What?
We made it through almost this whole video without talking about the sex scenes.
I mean, I don't think there's anything to say about it. Like,
I know, but they are so bad.
I want to see your fingernails on my throne, so that way when I sit here having important political meetings, I can imagine ramming you from behind.
God, the way they dirty talk is just the absolute worst. I don't understand. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Sex things that aren't the thing you're into always seem weird and dumb. And in this case, it's just painful. That's the sex scene in Throne that we haven't talked about was, is kind of notable because at the very end of it, she is in Zayden's mind where she's like,
and he feels her fluttering around his tongue.
I hate it. Also, there's like this weird brutish sexiness to men, sexual brutishness to men. I've noticed that female authors write that's just not a thing. Like, it's just not how men are, and it's not actually how men write men. It's just like this weird female fantasy of like, ugh, caveman.
Take me! I need the primal force of dick inside me.
It's like the men think like that all the time, and it's like, no, we don't. Nobody thinks like that. It's just like all a fantasy. Time. And it's honestly, it's sort of gross in a way in that, like, if this was flipped, this entire book would be so offensive.
Really?
I don't know. I find it, again, men's rights are not like the cause of the century, but I find it kind of gross, actually, how women write it that way. And the sex scenes just aren't good. Me and Katie broke down what makes a really bad sex scene in our Cyborg Tinkerer critique, if you would like to look there. There's things like mentioning certain kinds of anatomy always comes off as sort of stupid. It's a lot of that kind of thing. And again, they're dirty talk between two people. Like, if you've ever looked at dirty talk that you've done when you're not turned on, it sounds really
it's cringy as fuck. Let me tell you, I've read Maria's. It's cringy as fuck.
Calm down. I don't want to cut too much of this.
No, I literally was thinking about that. And I was thinking about just like times where sex has been very enjoyable and like what happened. And if I had to write that, and even though for me, I'm like, oh, that was a really like, I was having a great, it just doesn't like, it does not translate. Some stuff just, I think the sexiest thing you can do is be very vague.
Yeah, actually, I think so. It's so
actually,
true.
Yes. And fade to black. Because then the viewer can do all the work, and then whatever they want can happen. But unfortunately, at a certain point, if you just start writing...
Being horny is like being on a drug. It's kind of like when you're both... If somebody's high and talking to somebody else, and they both have like really think they're having really deep, meaningful thoughts, and if there's a videotape...
And it's really more like, what if McDonald's is accidentally...
Yeah, what if cars ran on water? It's like that.
And also, if you're like the sober person in the room, you're just like, this isn't fun. And as a reader, I'm just like, oh no.
And that's the thing. It's always going to seem like that. And that's why I think it should stay to fanfic and very specific erotica that has tags beforehand.
There is only so many ways you can say a dick is inserted into a vagina creatively until it becomes more like slapstick and no pun intended.
Don't write sex scenes. Fade to black. Be better writers. I don't know if I have any final thoughts for this. Like I said, this is a book about nothing that takes forever to get there. So many of these things in this could be cut. For again, example, the parts with the infantry, that doesn't go anywhere. It's not like at the end the infantry are the one who rise up to save their land because they have a different culture than the writers. It's not like her bonds with them go anywhere. It's not like any of those characters return. There's just like... Mm-mm. Like 30 pages about them in the wilderness that never do anything. That could have just been cut.
Varish could be cut. That whole
plot. Oh my god, yes. That was so dumb. I swear to god.
And it doesn't play into the final, like, it's not like he's the big bad at the end of the book or he's working for the big bad or like him and Jack Barlow were both Venom and that's what was happening. No. Varish could have just disappeared.
The only part I liked about it was that he tortured Violet and that was about it.
Oh, some people wanted me to talk about the torture. I actually don't think this is as bad as the torture in Iron Widow or a few of the others we've read because it didn't have the trope of the tortured person gives up the correct information. I think the big problem with this book is actually that she gets tortured and then never thinks about it again. There's a problem where just it's so
until
superhero
she's walking
logic.
Underground and she smells something that smells like it, like she's not tortured
and even then
she-
she's just kind of like, oh, Zayden, this happened, and he's like, well, burn it all to the ground. I fucking hate Zayden. I hate her. I hate how obsessed with her he is. This is a bad book. Don't read it. If you did, I'm sorry.
If you liked it,
no,
I'm so glad. If there are those Listen, I know there are going to be those of you who enjoyed this book, but also are happy to be here and watch us do all this because you read it and you also knew that it wasn't good. And there are going to be those of you who thought it was good. And like, go with God, my sons and daughters.
Look, yeah. Here's what I say.
Ditto.
It's okay. It's okay to like trash. Don't pretend it's not trash. Don't pretend it's not trash. But it's okay to be a trash raccoon sometimes, trash panda. Yeah, maybe think about what kind of reparations Yaros could give to the world to make up for this. Okay, anything else?
No.
No, I think that's it.
Okay, all right. We love you, our parasocial darlings.
Bye, guys.